You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new report finds that millions of Americans are at least 3 months behind on their car payments. We'll talk to an economist about what this could mean for consumers and the financial well-being of the country. First, Governor Tony Evers vetoed a Republican bill yesterday that would have used the state's budget surplus to give tax cuts to middle-class Wisconsinites. The governor said in a statement that he objected to passing a fiscal bill outside of the biennial budget process and said he was dismayed that the bill lacked bipartisan support. Republicans in the legislature have called the veto divisive. Our next guest is here to talk about the veto and what's happening at the Capitol. Sean Johnson is the State Capitol Bureau Chief for Wisconsin Public Radio News. Sean, welcome back.
Hey, Rob.
So talk us through the Republican plan. It passed the legislature, didn't pass the governor.
Yeah, the Republican plan is similar to what the governor talked about on the campaign. It's similar to what he's talked about this year. I think the big difference, and it is a big one as far as, you know, both parties are concerned here, is how the Republican plan is paid for versus how Evers wants to partially pay for his tax cut. So Evers wants to, if he's going to have a tax cut, an income tax cut, he wants to offset that by scaling back a tax credit for manufacturers. Republicans are saying that is a non-starter for them, and so that is a pretty big chasm between the parties on this, and that's where they stand today.
And everybody here, the governor, Republicans, say they want this middle-class tax cut. That's something they agree on. It's just the where the money comes from. What were Republicans using here?
They were using money that's in the state budget right now, basically. I mean, a balance in the state budget, and in future budgets, they would, you know, essentially require legislatures to make decisions and prioritize the tax cut. They would either have to get rid of it or find the money somewhere. So there's no specific source of new funding to offset the lost revenue from the tax cut. It would just be using a balance that's there right now.
And the governor has made the case that that's a temporary fix, in effect.
Yeah, he's saying that if you do that, you're either not going to have money for the tax cut in future budgets, or because of this tax cut, you're not going to have money for other priorities like schools.
And this manufacturing tax cut, give us a little bit of the background on that. That's been pretty controversial over the last year or so.
Yeah, it has. I mean, this is something that Governor Walker included, he didn't include it in his initial budget, but Republican lawmakers added it to his first budget in 2011. Walker signed it, and this is a very large tax credit for manufacturers in Wisconsin, effectively zeroes out their tax burden here. And so what's happened is, as this reduces revenues for state government, Democrats are kind of saying, you know, sounding the alarm on this. Look, this is something that we have to take care of. This is a problem. Republicans keep pointing to it as a reason things are good in Wisconsin right now. They credit it with helping the economy.
Right. They've pointed it toward it as a reason for job growth since the Great Recession. Critics of that way of thinking say our job growth has tracked pretty well national trends. So, and there have been efforts to measure the impact of that, and some economists say, yeah, it has helped us here in Wisconsin.
Yeah, I mean, it is tricky to measure the impact of it because, some of the efforts that have seen it look at border counties, but not all the border counties, you know. So, the economy is doing well in Wisconsin by metrics we all look at. The unemployment rate is low. But whether or not this tax credit has something to do with that, because the tax credit does not award job creation, for example. I mean, you don't have to create a job to get the tax credit. That's the argument that you hear from Democrats. Also, the fact that, you know, as you mentioned, the national economy is doing pretty well.
Talking to WPR Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson about the Governor Evers' veto of a Republican middle-class tax cut plan. And Governor Evers presumably is going to offer up details on his own plan when he presents his budget next week, right?
Yeah. So Evers initially latched on to this Democratic plan that, again, it was similar to the one that Republicans talked about. But Evers' proposal that he talked about initially would offer individuals who earn below $80,000 and families that earn below $125,000 a 10% tax credit. So that plan is slightly different than he talked about on the campaign. There's a chance that what he offers in the budget would be slightly different than what he talked about, you know, a couple weeks ago as he builds the rest of the budget and, you know, finds other sources of revenue, other pots of money. I mean, the budget is kind of like an interlocking puzzle. You know, you change one thing over here, it affects something else over there. So I can't say for certain that the tax credit that or the tax cut that he talked about a few weeks ago would be what he's going to have in his budget. But that is something that he said he supported recently.
We'll all be watching for that next week. I wanted to touch on some other news today, really, Sean, on the outcome of this lame duck session of the legislature late last year, that affected the powers of the governor and the attorney general. Those are two big parts of it. The governor is a defendant, weirdly, in a lawsuit. Technically, he's defending some of those changes that limited his power. But what did he have to say about it in a court case today?
But he happens to agree with plaintiffs. So the governor is kind of a defendant in his official capacity as governor. But the governor in one of the state lawsuits today, the one filed by unions, including Service Employees International Union, the governor said he agrees with plaintiffs and they have a likelihood of success. And that he wants Dane County Circuit Court to immediately block the laws that were passed in the December extraordinary session or lame duck session of the legislature. So he's also a defendant in another state lawsuit. He's going to file something in that case, I believe, tomorrow. And so it may be a hint of the argument you're going to hear from the governor in a lot of these cases where he's officially a defendant, but he wants these laws gone.
We have, up till today, three lawsuits over this lame duck session. Check me on this. A federal lawsuit specifically on the voting changes that were there.
Correct.
We had the state lawsuit you just mentioned from a labor group. And then there's another lawsuit from the League of Women Voters and other organizations challenging the process, saying, hey, the lame duck session never happened.
Very good.
I'm right so far.
You are right on those three.
Okay, but it gets more complicated. Lawsuit number four.
We got a new one today.
Yes.
This one filed by the Democratic Party of Wisconsin. This one is in federal court. And this one says that the lame duck session violated the U.S. Constitution in a variety of ways. Violated people's rights or states' rights to a Republican form of government. That's a small r, Republican form of government. And essentially, by taking away the will of voters. Also said that the lame duck session violated the First and 14th Amendments to the U.S. Constitution. So now we have two lawsuits in federal court, two lawsuits in state court. I'm not going to say that we won't have a fifth because I don't think we saw this one coming necessarily.
Right, and this is the Democratic Party of Wisconsin raising this lawsuit. Who defends it in this case? Do we know yet?
So this one is filed against a variety of Republican lawmakers, including Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, other legislative leaders. It is also filed against Governor Tony Evers in his official capacity as governor. The tricky thing with all of these is that typically it would be the state attorney general who defends the state in cases like these. But remember, our attorney general, Josh Call, has been very critical of the lame duck lawsuits. The lame duck lawsuits are challenging powers that were taken away from the attorney general's office. And so Call has said he has a conflict of interest in these cases. And so he has not defended the initial cases. This is a new one. We'll have to make a new decision. But I think it's fair to, you know, it'd be a decent guess to say that Josh Call probably won't defend this case either. And so Republicans on these other cases have reached out to private attorneys to, you know, argue for them and to defend these laws.
And these are all still pretty fresh and new lawsuits. We might not have results on these for, well, depending on appeals, for months, maybe even years, right?
Yeah, so in the state cases, you know, the League of Women Voters cases, the unions case, those are in Dane County Circuit Court. And so, you know, you could imagine, given the way other Dane County Circuit Court cases have gone, potentially a Dean County judge would rule against these laws or some portion of them. But they are not moving quickly if that's the way they're leaning. I mean, they're given time for them to be briefed. There's going to be hearings on those cases next month. Now, in the other federal case, the old one we'll call it, that the one that's specifically on voting laws, that is the judge there moved more quickly and said already that those changes have to be put on hold because they're similar to other Republican-authored restrictions on early voting that judge already blocked.
So maybe for our pledge drive coming up, Sean, we make a scorecard as a thank you gift of all the lawsuits. Of course, there might be a fifth one.
I feel
one.
Like it could be out of date by the time a scorecard.
Back to the drawing board. Sean, thanks a lot for joining us.
You're welcome, Rob.
That's Sean Johnson, State Capitol Bureau Chief for Wisconsin Public Radio News. He joined us to talk about Governor Evers' veto of a Republican-backed tax cut bill, plus the latest legal challenges to the lame duck session of the legislature and the laws they passed in December. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. An infectious disease expert recently testified to Minnesota lawmakers that chronic wasting disease, currently affecting deer, among others, could soon affect people. We'll talk about that risk and the state of CWD in Wisconsin coming up. First, a new report from the Federal Reserve Bank in New York finds that some 7 million Americans are at least 3 months behind on their car payments. While the economy overall looks like it's in good shape, delinquent payments on cars in particular can be a red flag for some analysts. Our next guest is here to talk about the report and what it could signal for the economy as a whole. Thomas Kemp is a professor and the Economics Department Chair at UW-Eau Claire. Tom, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, I'm happy to be here.
Well, we have this Federal Reserve report, 7 million Americans behind on their car payments by at least 3 months. So there's a lot of economic statistics out there, of course. As an economist, what's your reaction to this particular indicator?
Yeah, well, it means that a lot of people are in rough shape, a lot of people struggling out there. Of course, the car loans, so these are things that people depend upon to get to work, get kids to school, get where they need to go. So they're a fairly critical component of their day-to-day life. If they can't afford them or they're going into default and getting repossessed, that obviously has a huge, huge impact on a whole lot of people.
Now, we'll dig into the individual impacts a little more. Some people, it seems like, are worried at a macro level. They're saying, okay, maybe like the housing issues of 10, 11 years ago, there's these companies that bundle up all these loans. If enough of them go bad, we start to see serious damage to the whole economy. Do you have that kind of big picture worry if we have all these loans going unpaid?
Yeah, I don't see anything at this stage in the data that would suggest that this trend would cause some kind of massive macroeconomic problem similar to the housing crisis of a little better than 10 years ago. It's a big problem for a lot of individuals, but I don't see this as an aggregated macro crisis. No.
There's been a lot of talk since the Great Recession about the slow recovery and maybe not really paying off for a lot of workers around the country. Do you see this as maybe a sign that people aren't feeling the full benefits of the recovery?
Yeah, well, you put your nail, put right on the head of the nail right there with that. When we dig down into this sort of auto loan crisis, if you want to call it that, we find that most of these defaults, most of the people who are having a hard time, they're in these subprime markets. So they're people with relatively low credit scores. They're generally financed by auto finance companies rather than a regular diverse bank. And so it's just this lower end of the spectrum that is really seeing very high default rates. In fact, the folks with higher credit scores, higher incomes, those default rates are actually down a little bit than they were before. So it's really the problem is isolated in a fairly small segment of the economy, and it reinforces that story that we've heard so much about for a couple of years now of this segment of society that just wages just aren't keeping up, not able to afford the things they need to get by it day to day.
Now, compared to the end of 2010, the overall default rate is a little lower now than it was then. So I'm trying to figure out the math in my head. Does this all mean that more people are getting these loans than they were at that point? So even though the absolute number of loans we're seeing in default is up, maybe that's not as bad as it might sound, just because there's a larger number of those loans to begin with.
That's correct. So the market has grown since 2010, and so again, that's one of the signals why I don't see this as the level of crisis that it's not even comparable to what was going on in 2007, 2008, leading up to the last housing crisis. So no, it's a problem, but it's not a widespread problem. As I say, it's more isolated to a segment of the market, and You know, it's a segment that we hear a lot about, and we probably all know a lot about. Down in the lower end of the income spectrum, we have higher default rates. We're observing a larger number of people who are having problems affording transportation, personal transportation.
Talking to economics professor Tom Kemp from UW Eau Claire, looking at this new report out from one of the Federal Reserve agencies, Federal Reserve Bank in New York, finding over 7 million Americans are 3 months or more behind on their car payments. Tom, are there economic policies that could help people in this situation, the people at this sort of tenuous level where they need that car to get to work, as you were saying, they can't afford to pay for it?
Yeah, I think it's a hard problem to solve. I would say in the longer term, cities that are looking towards alternative transportation methods are probably on the right track. Maybe personal cars isn't a long-term solution, but that doesn't get us anywhere in the short run, right? That doesn't help the person who can't pay for their car this month or next month, because it isn't going to happen. But in the short run, I think a good sound financial planning, being careful, thinking about the total cost of a car loan, what's it going to cost me to own this car, figuring in repair costs, consult maybe even a financial planner or somebody to talk a little about this. Don't necessarily take the first loan you're offered. Shop around. A lot of times auto loan rates vary significantly from some markets to other markets across different types of financial institutions by as much as 300%. So, shop around for credit, plan accordingly, make sure you can afford what you're getting yourself into is probably the best strategy for tomorrow.
Now, among the many problems before 2008 in the housing industry was this idea that there were predatory lenders out there giving high-risk loans and then ultimately bundling them up, which made it even worse when a lot of them failed. Do we see any kind of predatory lending, what we would call predatory lending in this auto market?
Well, I would be hesitant to say words like predatory. I would say that we know that the bulk of the subprime loans in these markets are being issued by auto financing companies. So that's like, you go to the dealership, you get a loan, rather than going to, say, your local bank and getting a loan. Those interest rates are considerably higher than you'd see in other places as well. So, are there folks going out there? Is there a set of deceptive practices going on like we saw in the housing crisis? I don't see anything in, I'm looking at three different Fed reports here in front of me. I don't see anything that would get me that far down that road of saying predatory. But I would say that what we do know is pretty clear that if you're taking out a car loan, you're looking at buying a new car, definitely shop around and definitely don't necessarily take, the rate that's offered you by the dealer that you're buying your car at. Not to say that might not be a good deal, but, get a second to third estimate for sure and then consider, the total cost to that loan. Whether there's predatory things going, maybe I wouldn't rule it out, but I also wouldn't say for sure either.
Now, we're focusing in for this conversation on a negative indicator in the economy, but there are a lot of more positive ones. What kind of things are you looking at as you evaluate the American economy today?
Well, I'm looking at wages. So wages, of course, are coming up. It's been a long time in coming, but finally they're starting to come up, which is a good sign for everybody. Business startups, another good indicator. Sort of household spending patterns. People seem to still be spending at a pretty good clip, which would suggest that they feel good about their future. They can buy things. That's the main driver of the economy. So those are some of the more important variables. I mean, people look at housing starts too. I think that's important variable as well, but I think one of the most important ones is sort of what's going on with household spending, and that seems to be pretty strong still.
Let's bring on a caller. Dennis is with us in Two Rivers. Dennis, hi.
Hi. I was wondering, with some of these loans that are about to be in default, instead of it just being people who borrowed money to buy a vehicle, how many of these loans might be from people using their vehicle title to get a loan.
Dennis, thanks for the call. So those car title loans, I think, would be in a separate category from the ones we've been talking about. Do I have that right as far as you know, Tom?
Yeah, that would be my understanding as well. But it raises a related question of you know, how. Of course, now we have sort of freelance taxi services and things like that, right? Like, you know, name brands, Uber and Lyft and things. I think it's a relevant question to ask how many people are taking out car loans thinking that they have a revenue stream associated with that vehicle, and then finding out that maybe the revenue stream isn't where they thought it was. You know, that may be playing into this somewhat too, particularly when you look at the age breakdown of the defaults. I mean, it's across the age spectrum, but certainly the 18 to 29 year old segment is the where the majority of the where the most largest share of the defaults are. So that's I think a good question to bring up.
Dennis, thanks for that call. And as we wrap up, Tom, I'm glad you brought that up. I wanted to ask, is this a case where people are defaulting on auto loans and maybe they're struggling with student loan debt too, a particular generational problem?
Yeah, I haven't seen any correlation between those two debts, but I'd be pretty surprised if it wasn't the case. Like I said, the default rates are up across age spectrum, so I don't want to, you know, lay this on young folks entirely. It's across the spectrum, but most notably in the 18 to 29 segment. So I think it's highly likely that they're struggling with a lot of debt in general.
Tom, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Sure, happy to do it. Happy to do it.
That's Tom Kemp, professor and department chair of economics at UW-Eau Claire. He joined us today to talk about a new report that shows a record 7 million Americans are at least 3 months behind on car payments and what that means about our economy. Coming up, we'll talk about the state of chronic wasting disease here in Wisconsin and why the illness that mostly affects deer is getting national attention. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, an infectious disease expert recently issued a warning about the dangers of chronic wasting disease. CWD has been around for nearly 50 years, and it's been reported in 24 states, including Wisconsin. It attacks the brains of deer, elk, moose, and caribou. It's always fatal. So far, the disease has not spread to people, but Michael Osterholm of the University of Minnesota told state lawmakers earlier this month that he thinks it's just a matter of time.
Probable that human cases of chronic wasting disease associated with consumption of chronic wasting disease contaminated meat will be documented in the years ahead. It's possible the number of human cases will be substantial and will not be isolated events.
So what do we know about CWD and its risks? Brian Richards is the Emerging Disease Coordinator at the U.S. Geological Survey's National Wildlife Health Center, which is based in Madison. Brian, thanks a lot for joining us in the studio.
Thanks for having me.
Well, that question raised, right now, CWD, not something that has affected people yet, according to that person. Is this something that is on your radar?
Well, the impacts, the potential human impacts of chronic wasting disease are always going to be on a radar screen. And, you know, Dr. Osterholm has a great reputation, and certainly he's entitled to his professional opinions regarding what will happen in the future. My position, I try and follow the science wherever I go. And so when we look to, you know, what's really out there, we can say definitively there are no known cases where CWD has crossed that species barrier into a human host. And we can look at the bulk of the science, the bench science that's been done to date, and it's what we would term an open question. Some researchers have been able to push CWD across that species barrier into a model of human health. Others have failed to do so. So it's kind of an open question. So to say it's going to definitively or it's not going to definitively is beyond the scope of what science can support today.
We'll spend most of our time talking about what we do know about CWD and in deer and other animal populations in the United States. I want to bring up something that's been in the headlines. This has been in the news a lot lately. We keep seeing it headlined, zombie deer disease. Watching this thing in Wisconsin for a long time, it struck me as sensationalistic, and you too, it sounds like.
Yeah, the first time I saw this term, I think it was between 1, maybe 2 years ago. And, you know, I guess it was likely, a title writer or, someplace in the media where I guess my best guess would be that it was sensationalistic, trying to draw attention to features of this disease. But from the wildlife health perspective, when you look at these animals are suffering from a progressive neurological degeneration. And when they reach that stage where, they've lost fear of humans, the low head, the drooling behavior, they're very near death. So the term zombie disease really does not describe the clinical profile of these animals, and I'm not sure whether it really helps the conversation. As you noted, it's a very, very important disease to keep track of, to monitor, both in animals and, other potential impacts. But name changes, I guess in my humble opinion, really don't help us much.
Well, give us the basics. We've talked about CWD a lot on this network over the years. Give us the basics of what it is.
Okay, chronic wasting disease, or CWD, is a member of this family of diseases called transmissible spongiform encephalopathies, or short TSEs. To the best of our knowledge and scientific evidence, they're caused by a malformed protein, a protein that we all produce in our body that has been transitioned into a disease-associated form. When these disease-associated prion proteins congregate in the brain, they form into starchy plaques, and these plaques are associated with neuronal death. So that's where we get that progressive neurological degeneration as the population of neurons in your central nervous system decreases, you lose the ability ultimately, to be alive. So CWD is just one example of these diseases. There's a number of TSEs in mammals. In humans, we think of Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease. In domestic livestock, we've got two good examples. One in cattle is bovine spongiform encephalopathy, which the media referred to as mad cow disease. And we also have scrapie, a disease in domestic sheep, which has been known for over 300 years. So with regard to CWD, that's the only member of this family that's ever been reported in free-ranging wildlife. And we now have evidence of it in our North American members of the deer family, including white-tailed deer, mule deer, elk, moose, and reindeer or caribou.
Talking to Brian Richards, Emerging Disease Coordinator at the U.S. Geological Survey's National Wildlife Health Center, looking at chronic wasting disease in Wisconsin and beyond. Can you talk about the state of CWD, Brian, here in Wisconsin?
I sure can. So we picked it up, or the state of Wisconsin picked it up due to surveillance, looking at dead animals, hunter-killed animals. They picked up the first two cases back in 2002. Since that point in time, the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources has done an exemplary job of conducting surveillance. They've looked at over 230,000 animals, hunter-killed and other samples in that intervening period. And, we picked it up initially in western Dane County. Now in free-ranging white-tailed deer, it's been picked up in 25 separate counties. And if you look at game farms or captive cervid operations, that adds an additional 8 counties to the count. This last year is very interesting. In all time since we've picked up CWD in the state of Wisconsin, we found some 5,000, a little over 5,000 positives. Over 1,000 of those were detected last year. So interesting trends we've observed here in Wisconsin. Number one is an expanding geographic footprint or spread of disease. The second is in those core areas. And what I'm talking about is kind of where Iowa, Dane, Sauk, and Richland counties come together, a little ways west of here. We've seen an increase in prevalence or the proportion of each animal unit being affected. So you get over in that core area just south of Spring Green, and if you look at adult males, so bucks, 2.5 years and older, the prevalence or proportion positive is between 40% and 50%. So you think about that from a disease perspective. So if you go out there hunting, or wildlife watching, and you're fortunate enough to see, you know, a big adult male take a coin out of your pocket, flip it up in the air, and that's the chances that each individual animal has this always been fatal, contagious neurological disorder.
The trend here seems to be spreading in area, this disease, and it sounds like you're saying deepening in concentration over time. Is that what we're seeing across the country?
We see, we're definitely seeing impacts of geographic spread. In areas where the disease has been known the longest, we see clear evidence of increasing prevalence. And the other thing that we see, and we now have peer-reviewed science supporting this in white-tailed deer, mule deer, and in elk, that where the disease has been long enough and when prevalence gets high enough, we start seeing disease absolutely impact herd performance and, in a couple instances, driving herd decline. So spreading, growing, and population impacts in the cervid host. Those are the key features.
Now, as I understand, these proteins, these prions, you know, these aren't viruses. They aren't bacteria, which means you can't do a vaccine. There's no antiviral, antibiotics. They're all irrelevant. That said, what have we done? What strategies have been tried to stop this?
Okay, well, we saw something here. Early intervention attempts by the state of Wisconsin was aggressive response, trying to dramatically lower the deer population in hopes that if you got the deer population low enough, you would interrupt the disease transmission cycle on the ground. So if you lower population and you have diseased animals out there, certainly you're going to remove some diseased animals. These animals are no longer capable of shedding infectious agent out into the environment. They're no longer capable of directly transmitting disease to other animals. And they're no longer capable of dispersing, moving 10, 20 miles down the road and establishing a new focus of disease there. So reducing deer population is an important tool that we have available. Now, that was not very popular in the state of Wisconsin. It hasn't been popular elsewhere. We think about the users of natural resources, hunters, folks that like to, you know, feed deer to attract them, to watch them. Well, those are great things. So now we have folks that enjoy natural resources in a way that they and their families have always been able to enjoy. And now because of disease, we're asking those folks, those great folks, to change their behaviors to try and preserve this resource for future generations. And the pushback has been fairly steady and dramatic. Here in Wisconsin, the pushback led to legislative maneuvers which in essence forced the DNR to back down from aggressive management techniques. And we've seen the results of that. You know, a few years ago, we had a deer trustee hired in the state of Wisconsin who suggested a more passive approach to CWD. And I think the documented change in distribution we see on the ground is proof positive that passive leads to more disease.
We're talking about chronic wasting disease in Wisconsin's deer population and beyond. He's the with Brian Richards, Emerging Disease Coordinator at the U.S. Geological Survey's National Wildlife Health Center. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a hunter? Do you eat venison? Are you worried about CWD? What do you think of the job the state is doing trying to manage the spread of chronic wasting disease? Are there things that you think we should be doing that we aren't? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about chronic wasting disease. Brian Richards is our guest. He's the Emerging Disease Coordinator at the U.S. Geological Survey's National Wildlife Health Center based in Madison. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you worried about this disease in Wisconsin's deer herd? And what questions do you have about it or how the state is managing it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go to your calls now. Jay is with us in Birchwood. Jay, hi.
Hey, gentlemen. Thanks for taking my call. Kind of a two-pronged question or comment, and the guest has kind of touched on both of them. The baiting and feeding of wild deer. I live in northern Wisconsin, and for years I have been trying to get folks to realize that it is a dangerous practice, because congregating any wild animal like that is going to have consequences. And I just wanted to get the your guest's take on kind of our reactive rather than proactive, you know, this business of banning, baiting, and feeding in a county only after deer have been discovered with the disease makes no sense to me.
Jay, thanks a lot for the call. Baiting and feeding of deer, Brian.
So to start with, you know, I want to clarify that policy issues and regulatory maneuvers put in place in the state of Wisconsin are the prerogative of the state of Wisconsin. I'm a federal authority, and I try to provide science-based evidence and support to the state when they request it. So with regard to feeding and baiting, what we're looking at is artificially congregating animals in space and time. So if all the animals are completely healthy, likely not a bad practice. But now if we put one animal who's actively shedding infectious agent, you know, disease-associated prion protein, into the mix, then we're definitely enhancing. We call that an amplification risk, and we're greatly increasing the risk of transmission in that space and time.
Thanks a lot for the call, Jay. We'll go next to Mike with us in Mauston. Mike, hi.
Hello there. How are you guys?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Mike?
Okay, I wanted to ask, I guess, with the increased numbers of positive deer, if I harvested deer, would you recommend still eating that deer even though I sent a test in and it came back negative?
Well, that's a great question. Mm-hmm. So I am not a human health expert, so I'm not going to give you human health advice, but I will defer to what the U.S. Centers for Disease Control does give advice, and it's out there on their website, easy to find. So their guidance for hunters is if you hunt in an area where CWD is known to exist, that you, the hunter, strongly consider having that deer or elk tested. But then there's no bones. If it comes back positive, they recommend not consuming any portion or any tissues from that animal. So now part of your question led to, you know, if that animal tests negative or not detective. Certainly there is a possibility, and we know that there are false negative tests. So even if that animal comes back not detected, there is a small chance that that animal is CWD positive. But now on the bright side, the only false negative results out there are when an animal is very early in the course of disease. And therefore, the chances that disease-associated prion protein has been deposited in tissues you're going to eat in venison are very, very low. So the tests that are available through the DNR are really solid tests. If it's positive, it's absolutely positive. The CDC says don't eat it. And if it's negative, you have a high degree of comfort about the disease state of that animal and the minimal risk it poses.
And a key point, thanks a lot for that call. You can't look at a deer, alive or dead, and know whether it has CWD.
Not until the very end stage of disease. We, you know, in your typical deer, the incubation period, the time from infection to the time that animal dies is someplace in the neighborhood of 2 years. And that animal looks and acts, at least to our eyes, very healthy. His behavior is normal, looks great. Right up until the end, maybe 18, 20, 22 months, it looks and acts perfectly healthy. Remember, it's a progressive neurological degeneration. So we only see those clinical signs at the very end of disease. So no, you can't tell by looking at a deer.
Let's go to another caller now. Russ is with us in Neenah. Russ, hello.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Russ?
Well, I believe that game farms have spread this disease throughout the country. Why are they continued to allow to be open?
Russ, thanks for the call. There's been a lot of attention to the role of game farms where deer are brought together and then hunted on that land. What have you seen?
Well, it's interesting. In the state of Wisconsin, I believe right now we've had detected CWD in 26 separate captive cervid facilities. In the entire lower 48, we've had, 105 or 106. So literally one out of four positive game farms has been here in the state of Wisconsin. Now, certainly because, you know, the business model includes movement of live animals, we have strong supporting evidence that game farms have moved CWD around the landscape. But they're certainly not the only cause. Game farms, as part of the question was, why are they allowed? Well, again, that's a question that needs to be dealt with by the legislatures of various states. It's a lawful activity in Wisconsin currently, and has been for many, many years. So that's why they're out there. Now, if you could wave a magic wand and think that, you know, I'll get rid of all the game farms and that's going to make CWD go away, you'd be sadly mistaken.
There has been talk about efforts, and there was briefly an emergency rule that got shot down requiring more fencing, double fencing, to prevent those captive populations from coming into contact with wild populations. How big a factor is that?
So the idea there is that if you have a single fence separating captive deer and wild deer, that there's a great chance for contact, nose-to-nose contact, which could lead to shedding infectious agent between, you know, one side of the fence or the other. So by putting up a second barrier, some, you know, 8-10 feet, something like that apart, it precludes the opportunity for that nose-to-nose contact. But we have seen examples, one right in Iowa County, where a captive facility that had a double fence, CWD showed up inside of that fence. So we know that even having a double barrier is not an absolute. But is it better than a single fence from an epidemiological standpoint? Yes.
Talking to Brian Richards, wildlife disease expert at the U.S. Geological Survey, talking about chronic wasting disease in deer in Wisconsin. Back to your calls. Mark is with us in Waukesha. Mark, hi.
Hey, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. No, I'm thrilled to hear you guys talking about this. And my hope is with the new governor and the new head of the DNR that things will take place at a much more rapid and aggressive fashion. During the tenure of Scott Walker, he had appointed Kathy Stepp at one point, which is a real step back for the state of Wisconsin. She was quoted as saying that CWD is not a concern and it's a waste of the DNR's time.
Mark, thanks for the call. I know you probably don't want to dive too far into the politics here, but what would you suggest when it comes to more proactive things that Mark is looking for?
Well, certainly, you know, the idea that CWD is not a serious disease, that's an opinion. And I would argue that the data, the science, does not support that opinion. I would argue that the data and the science supports that CWD is a very, very serious issue. Just looking at the spread and the increase in prevalence here in the state of Wisconsin, and just the idea that, you know, doing the surveillance, the hunter-based surveillance last year, the DNR was able to pick up over 1,000 positives. That's a pretty big number, and lends some credibility that, hey, this is not nothing.
Are we doing enough research, apart from the management efforts, are we doing enough research into what this disease is and how it spreads?
Well, I guess I would have to argue, and quite selfishly, that there's never enough research being done. You mentioned earlier, we don't have vaccines. We don't have therapeutics. We don't have great tools. And the only way we will change that dynamic is by investing in research into this disease.
Do you feel a sense of urgency from Wisconsin and other states and from the federal government and from hunters, for that matter?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think there's a lot of camps out there, and there are certainly folks that believe that Wisconsin has wasted a lot of time and money. But again, I don't believe that the disease supports that. So, you know, if we are to be successful, what we need to do is get accurate, valid scientific information into the hands of the stakeholders. And those stakeholders have to decide how the state of Wisconsin and other states want to proceed. And they do that through, you know, through the ballot.
Brian, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
That's Brian Richards, Emerging Disease Coordinator at the U.S. Geological Survey's National Wildlife Health Center. We talked with him about chronic wasting disease, whether it could affect humans, and how the state is managing the spread of that illness among the white-tailed deer population. So far, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says there have been no reports of CWD in people. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, a Supreme Court justice wants to make changes that would make it easier to sue news outlets for libel. We'll look at the First Amendment protections for journalists and what could change. We'll preview a new documentary about Nazi rallies in pre-World War II America and find out what was going on at that time here in Wisconsin. And it's this week's edition of Food Friday. From hummus to stews to pomegranates, we'll get a taste of recipes from Palestinian cuisine. All that, plus our weekly roundup of news from around Wisconsin, it's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.